You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 220.
On today's show, we talk about kites, poops, and receipts.
Let's dig a little deeper, but make sure you got that protective gear on. All right. Welcome to the show, everybody. Rachel, how's it going?
Great. I'm great.
I like how when I just hit record and you're not prepared
for it. I had no idea you were hitting record, so I'm like talking about something else. And you're like, welcome to the show. I'm like, okay, all right.
Yeah.
Doing this.
Yeah. So we are actually recording from North Carolina. We bounced across the country.
Yes, but not with the RV. We flew here to visit my family.
Yes, that's right.
for the Memorial Day holiday.
Yep, going out to the ocean for the week.
Yeah.
It's going to be nice.
Yeah, so. Super fun.
Anyway, that's neither here nor there. There is archaeology there.
Well, it is here.
And it's there.
Just, well, it was there, but now it's here.
And then it's going to be there.
So it will be there.
Okay. So we talked, and I'll link to this in the show notes, because coincidentally, I just talked about this on the Rock Art podcast with Dr. Alan Garfinkel.
And you guys went way in depth on it.
We did, because he's a rock art expert. But desert kites. Mm-hmm. It was episode 165, 169, something like that, that we talked about this as a news article, and they're back in the news. So let's talk about that. The link is again in the show notes, but desert kites are pretty prominent in Jordan and Saudi Arabia. In fact, there's tons of them there. There's also some in Syria and some other places.
Kind of all over the Middle East, but that's where they're clustered at.
Right. We'll get to some densities a little bit later, but they date to anywhere from, you know, 7 or so to 9,000 years old.
Yeah.
And they're basically game drive structures.
Yeah.
Used to herd gazelles and antelopes into pits in the corners.
Where they could then, you know,
kill them
and have them for food.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of them. And it was clearly like a pretty common method of of hunting in that time period in that place.
Yeah. And some of them, some single kites, they know just because of things found around it that they've been used for over 1,000 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they use these things pretty regularly.
Yep.
But we'll talk about some of their purpose later on. But anyway, how would you know how to build one?
Yeah.
You know, they all kind of look the same.
And how would you know to do it too, right? Yeah. Like where does that knowledge come from?
Right. Well, an archaeologist named Remy Cressard from the French National Center for Scientific Research has done a study. And this wasn't like recent research. Some of these things have been known for a little while. And he's just kind of pulled everything together into this article. But he says they found what people are calling blueprints for these complex structures actually carved on boulders nearby.
Okay.
So
rock art, basically.
Well, they are rock art.
Yeah.
It's rock art.
Yeah.
They're inscribed. And they look to scale just like the desert kites that are on the ground near them.
That's really cool. So that's one way to transition or share the knowledge of how to do these things from one person or one group to another.
Yeah. Some people are calling this the oldest like blueprints or plans that you see for your monumental structure.
Mm-hmm.
There have been other plans like this kind of found mostly from Egypt. You know, you see drawings of like pyramids and stuff like that.
Yep.
And some from Mesopotamia around 7,000 years old. But nothing has ever been this like precise and drawn to scale and this old at the same time.
Right, right.
Right. So, I mean, there's obviously been precise things illustrated, but not that were this old.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, people just didn't realize how, I guess, the knowledge that they had of doing these kinds of things back then. And I've always said, you know, our brains aren't really all that much different than they were 15,000-20,000 years ago right now. We may have a little bit of different cognitive development because we did live in a different culture and society, obviously, but they were certainly capable of doing whatever they needed to do.
Yeah, for sure.
You know?
Yeah. So this drawing or blueprint, if you want to call it that, it was found beside one of the ancient kites in Jordan, and it was an engraving of a kite that's roughly 80 centimeters long, 32 centimeters wide, and that's about 32 inches by 13 inches. And that it sounds like that basically matches the nearby kites. Like it's a plan for one of the larger ones that you can see in the landscape.
Yeah, there's 7 other nearby kites built to the same blueprints.
Yeah, yeah. So they're all
and
the same.
They're star-shaped, essentially. I think I mentioned that in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
It's a star-shaped enclosure with pits in the corners and curved driving lines, right?
And like star-shaped is very...
Yeah.
That's subjective, I feel like. Because like when you look at it, it's like a blobby star that might be running. It's, I don't know.
It's only star-shaped in the fact that it's got, I think, like five actual pits on it.
And there's like five points that each have a pit on the end of them. They're kind of cool looking. Like, there's the points coming off of this larger area. And then at the end of each of those points, you can really see that there is like this circular thing that was probably the pit. And some of them are bigger than others, too. So it is clearly a very well thought out piece of architecture.
Yeah, one of those big ones was actually found in 2015. It's a desert kite inscribed on a sandstone boulder, and the boulder itself is about 9 feet wide by six feet tall. They didn't really mention how big the inscription was, but it's implied that it's way bigger.
It's as big as the size of the rock. That boulder.
Possibly, yeah. And that boulder sits right smack in the middle of two pairs of star-shaped desert kites that correspond to the shapes on the engraving.
Very cool.
And it also said in the article that there's actually entrances to the kites, like kind of like openings, I guess. Mm-hmm. These weren't like huge walls. They were only a couple rocks high.
Yeah.
It was enough to, I guess, thwart the gazelle and the antelope because they're like, nope, that looks different. I'm going the other way.
Yeah. It's kind of crazy that they wouldn't just jump over it. But if it was too scary and weird to them, they wouldn't risk it, right?
No.
Too risky.
It was too foreign. And they were being chased and they were nervous. And, you know, they were fleeing because they don't fight.
Right.
But and they said that, I guess, near this boulder, there was actually some openings there because they would drive game into the kite.
Mm-hmm.
Right. They first had to kind of get them in there. They'd probably go in just naturally because if they're just chill and, you know, looking for food, they'll probably just step over the rocks.
Right.
But if they're all, you know, hurried and being chased, you know, it looks like something different. So
they're stampeding, basically, right?
Yeah. But they did have kind of entrances that could be used to sort of drive them into the enclosure. Mm-hmm. And these enclosures were enormous. I mean, they're not like a pen.
Yeah.
Like, they're huge.
Yeah. If it was small, I imagine that the desire to not jump over it would go away and they would just do it because it was small and they had nowhere else to go. But these big ones, they could sort of run around within it and not have to jump over a wall, you know? So that, I think that's how that worked.
Now, these have been called world's oldest blueprints, which implies that they were made before the actual desert kites were made.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't actually know that, right?
True.
So what could be some other uses of it? Well, they say that they could be maps of already constructed kites, like they made the desert kite and then etched it on the rock, inscribed it on the rock in order to use for planning.
Right.
Like, okay, so, you know, John, you're going to be over here. Mike, you get over there and then we're going to do this. I'm sure those weren't
John
their names.
John and Mike. Got
John
it.
John and Mike.
Yep.
Yep. They could also be used for, can you name it? What's one other thing they could be used for?
Ritual.
Yay. Because, and that's actually not too much of a joke.
No, it's not.
Some of these, again, there's evidence they've been used for thousands of years. And the archaeologist in the article here he basically said these people ate, slept, and breathed desert kites because it was their sole, not sole source, but it was a major source of their food.
Main source, yeah.
It would have been a big activity pretty much every day, if not week of their lives, because, you know, one antelope would feed a family for a week. But, you know, it would have been a constant activity and a constant probably maintenance and just thinking about these things.
Yeah, like as soon as they had one successful hunt, they'd probably begin planning the next one.
Yeah.
Because by the time they were done with the planning, you know, they'd finished the food they had and they needed to do it again.
Yeah. So for those reasons, it could have been ceremonial to gather around the boulder and almost like, you know, like today people would gather around something like that and pray, you know, and say, oh, let's do this thing. Right.
Yeah. Whatever rituals they had as people.
I mean, they do that before football games.
Yeah.
Right. Like it's just a thing people have done for a long time. So why wouldn't they have done it here?
I could totally see that for sure.
As a pre-hunting sort of thing.
Yeah.
Or even, you know, not that they met every Sunday for church, but, you know, something that where they would regularly meet to, like, you know, just give thanks or ask the gods, whatever they believed in, for, you know, favorable hunts or something.
Did it mention if there are any other markings on the rock with the kites?
They didn't mention them.
Okay.
Because that doesn't mean there aren't.
It would be interesting if it was some kind of like ownership type of thing, too. Like if there were multiple bands of people in the area, if one group were like, okay, I'm going to inscribe this on this rock here along with these other markings, and this says that this kite is mine, you know, like some kind of ownership sort of deal.
It's possible. Yeah. I think if there was, it would have been mentioned.
Yeah, they probably would have mentioned it.
It would also surprise me that there weren't any other markings, which might also lead to the ritualistic significance of these.
Could be.
Like you're not going to deface the rock with other stuff.
Yeah, totally.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, these things, like I said, are massive, and you might be thinking, well, how many of these could there possibly be? There's over thousand of them found across the Middle East and Central Asia.
So many.
Yeah.
I imagine, like, because they're not very tall, right? So that the construction of them was probably fairly simple.
Yeah.
You know what is interesting, though, is like we're looking at an aerial image of it, right? Mm-hmm. So we can see what the whole shape of it looks like from above, which would have been a view that they didn't have.
Right.
And I'm not going the ancient aliens route. Just get that out of your head. It's not a thing. Aliens didn't build these.
Sure.
But it does make you wonder, if they drew this on the rock after the fact, how would they know the exact shape? I don't know. It's like, it's the chicken and egg situation. Like,
not really, though. And I think people always say that, though, but I think that's our modern bias towards how we think of things. Because your average human today, us included, we don't often have to think of how something looks conceptually and then actually create that. But you actually do. Mm-hmm. Artists do this, right? Like you design knitting patterns and you get something in your head and you have to get that thing in your head down on a pattern.
Yeah.
Right. And then you have to make it in a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was more common for somebody living back in this environment to be able to conceive of how this is going to work. And even like pacing it out and saying, okay, so, you know, even though I can't see this from above, I know that, you know, on our drawing here, we have it going from here to here.
Yeah.
It would have been easier to reconstruct the drawing based on the thing.
That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah. Yeah. So maybe it did go that way.
And actually your comparison to knitting patterns is really interesting because I get an idea in my head and I'll sketch something out on paper for what I think it is going to look like or what I want it to look like. Mm-hmm. But then when you get into the actual mechanics of doing it, stuff changes, you know, like just that won't work the way I wanted it to. It changes. So that would make me think that if they are truly exact images or blueprints, then it was more of an after the fact drawing rather than a before drawing, unless they already had one that was successful that they liked and they were trying to copy it. And in that case, I would think that is, but it's still a copy of one that already happened. Anyway, that's just my speculation.
Yeah. Well, and it's possible that they had failed designs too, because of the sheer number of them, right?
Yeah, totally.
In parts of Syria, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia, there's up to one kite for every square kilometer.
So many kites.
I mean, it's just like you can't.
There's so many.
You can't walk through the desert without tripping over a desert kite.
Yeah, totally.
So, I'm like, why do antelope and gazelle even go there? It's just a death zone.
Well, but like you said, when they're just like moseying around grazing, they don't even know or care about it. It's when they get them running that they get scared and don't want to jump those walls.
Yeah. Well, like I said earlier, this shows that even 7,000 years ago or more, people are willing to design and construct monumental structures that utilize the landscape. And another thing you notice from this picture is there's at least two spots I can see on here. One on the left-hand side is, as the picture's oriented, where they use the natural boulders in the landscape as a border. And then in the upper right side of it, it almost looks like there's an outcropping there that they used as well.
It does. Yeah. They would take advantage of the natural landscape. Why not? Right. Use it to your advantage.
And in the bottom right and bottom left, it almost looks like this is on a little bit of a plateau and that it falls off into the pits. So the antelope would have like jumped down. There's probably people lying in wait down there.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, because the pits wouldn't necessarily hold the antelope. They had to like get in there pretty quick and kill whatever they needed for, you know, their hunt. Right.
Yeah.
Because I bet they would figure out they could jump the wall at some point and they would get out.
Well, they were probably so excited about doing these things that, much like the people of Jerusalem 2,500 years ago, they just crapped themselves with excitement.
Oh my God.
Back in a minute. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 220. And I didn't mention this at the beginning, but we kind of have a whole Middle Eastern theme going on here.
We do. Yeah, because this article is in Jerusalem, and actually, so is the next article. So it's like Middle Eastern and specifically Jerusalem.
I know.
Yeah.
So when you click on the link for this next article called Ancient Toilets Unearthed in Jerusalem Reveal a Debilitating and Sometimes Fatal Disease, it's a rock with a hole in it.
Uh-huh.
Now, it's a very square rock, which I find interesting. So it was definitely carved to be that
shaped
way.
That way.
Yeah, it was shaped that way.
Yeah.
There's a very good hole in it that looks like it was augured out with like a drill.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's an amazingly like symmetrical round hole.
Yep.
And I don't really know. Archaeologists always like to put scales and stuff, but then they don't put any measurements on it. So the scale's 100% useless.
Like, what is that scale?
It looks like it's probably 5 centimeters.
Yeah.
If I had to guess. It's probably not 10, but if it were 5, that would put it at
25 centimeters.
25 centimeters across, which is 12 inches, give or take. 10 inches.
4 inches for 10 centimeters.
Okay.
So,
So about 8, 10 inches.
Yeah, about that. Yeah.
Which isn't very big, which means this probably isn't 5 centimeters.
Yeah.
It's probably not 25 across.
Yeah.
Either way.
Either way, we have no idea because the scale is not defined.
I'll tell you what. I don't know if I could hit that hole no matter how big it is. It's pretty small. But
do you think there could have been an attachment on top of it? Like something that was bowl shaped to direct
like a pot.
Liquids. Yeah.
Well, we're getting ahead of ourselves.
We are. We do that all the time. We love to jump ahead.
I just want to point out that sometimes archaeology isn't as glamorous as TV and movies make it out to be.
Yeah.
We've definitely been in situations where we're just like hacking through briars. We're just scrambling over pits. We're picking up somebody else's cans and trash and just like measuring them in detail.
Yeah. Well, we are. As a group, we're obsessed with what gets left behind, right? And
we're obsessed with waste.
Yes, waste, trash.
Yes.
That's what we have. That's all we've got. So, yep. And you know what waste includes? Poop.
Poop. Yeah, that might be why, well, I wouldn't say this is true of all archaeologists. It's definitely true of us. We've gone like the other direction. Like I'm very conscious of my archaeological record I'm leaving behind and I don't want it to be big.
Are you doing like leave no trace archaeological record style?
I think I am. Yeah. Like I want to own very few things.
But that would be a physical waste.
Oh yeah,
your digital waste
and and then my latrine waste is actually just the same as everybody else's.
Yes, so, right. Anyway,
so in Jerusalem, some archaeologists analyzed 2,500-year-old poop from ancient pit toilets.
Why do you have to say poop like that?
You just have to.
Okay,
it's written in a CNN article.
Yeah. Well.
Yeah.
Poop happens.
That's right. So we'll get to it, but traces of dysentery causing parasites were found below two stone toilets belonging to elite households. And these weren't toilets in the same house.
No.
They were just two different stone toilets.
Two toilets, yeah.
Yeah. Now, Jerusalem at this time, 2,500 years ago, was at the center of the Assyrian Empire.
Mm-hmm.
It was home to between, and this is quite the range, 8,000 and 25,000 people.
That is quite the range.
We should have a better idea of that. I don't know why we don't.
I think it's just hard.
You
probably have conflicting records, and so you don't want to be wrong. So you just do the whole range, right?
Well, and it was also the center of the political and religious center of the Assyrian Empire.
Yeah.
You know, as it is for a lot of people today anyway.
Yeah.
But it was because of that, there were probably a lot of transients and travelers coming through.
Oh, sure. And probably certain times of year, there's more people there than other times because of various religious ceremonies and other things that would bring more people. So that might account for the range. It just depended on the time of year, the season. Yeah.
So I'm going to read a quote here from Dr. Pierce Mitchell, who's the lead author of the study that is referenced in the article. He says that dysentery is spread by feces contaminating drinking water or food. And we suspect it could have been a big problem in early cities of the ancient Near East due to overcrowding, heat and flies, and limited water available during the summer. So
makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, heat and flies. I mean, honestly, what that means is not only was the latrine or the pit that they dug out for this probably seeping into the drinking water,
mm-hmm.
but flies would just like land on this and then probably go land in a well that mm-hmm. has drinking water. They would just like transmit the feces around.
Well, and also like these two toilets that we're looking at specifically are really nice fancy stone toilets, right?
Yeah.
In the fancy houses.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think that the lower classes would have had a similar situation. No. And they might have been dumping waste like right into their water sources.
Right.
Like the river or whatever it was that they got their water from. So it probably could get pretty rank around there in the summer. Right.
People started living closer to each other and started living in cities before they figured out plumbing.
Yes, for sure.
And they just didn't understand how to do it. They just kept cramming more people into a small space.
And just didn't know what kind of effects the waste that they were creating was having.
Well, they had no idea these microorganisms exist.
Yeah.
They had no idea that, you know, disease was related to things like that. They mm-hmm. still thought that it was caused by gods and just like their behavior.
Yep.
And yeah. So anyway, eggs, which is so super gross, eggs of four types of intestinal parasites were found, including tapeworm, pinworm, roundworm, and whipworm.
Ugh. God, just the thought of that in my body is like, so gross.
I know. But the microorganisms that actually cause dysentery are fragile and pretty hard to find.
Oh.
So they use this technique that it's actually mentioned in the article. I didn't write it down in my notes because I didn't think it was important, but now I want to know what it is. It's called ELISA, ELISA, and it's all capital letters, which means it stands for something.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like CRISPR, which is I can't remember what it stands for, but that's like the technique they use to basically splice DNA.
Yeah.
But anyway, they use this technique, which essentially uses antibodies that bind on to proteins that are uniquely produced by particular species of single-celled organisms.
Okay.
So these single-celled organisms, they produce these proteins, and these guys, they know what they are, and they have these antibodies. Antibodies link themselves to proteins. That's what they do. And so if they latch on to a particular protein, that means it exists.
Okay.
Which means the species exists.
That means, okay, got it.
So you're basically linking onto their waste.
Yeah. Wow. That's so cool and really crazy.
I know.
Yeah.
They tested for entamoeba. I don't know how to say that. Entamoeba?
Yeah, entamoeba.
Entamoeba, Giardia, and Cryptosporidium. Cryptosporidium. Yeah. These are the most common microorganisms responsible for diarrhea and could be behind outbreaks of dysentery. Only the test for Giardia, however, was positive. The others were not.
Right. And Giardia is still a thing today. Like,
I know.
You hear about it at the hot springs in Nevada when there's cows nearby, and then the Giardia just gets into the system and into the hot spring, and you have to be very careful.
Isn't that what they call, like, when you're drinking from, like, streams where you have to clean the water? They call it beaver fever.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
They can transmit Giardia. Yeah. I mean, like we said, this area would have had to deal with these things first, because the Middle East was the first place where humans first developed agriculture, domesticated animals, and started creating settlements and becoming more sedentary. And from that came towns, cities, just more people crammed together in a smaller place. And they're all just, you know, having a good time drinking, making art, and creating fun new diseases for everybody to enjoy.
To enjoy together.
Yeah.
Yep. And just creating, and also this, die from, you know.
Right. They're just creating this petri dish where these microorganisms that have a life cycle that is extremely short can evolve quickly because of their short lifespan.
Yep.
Yeah. So that's gross.
Yeah. That's super gross. One of the interesting things about this article to me, though, is that the sort of class differences that you can sort of start imagining, like with this pretty beautiful, really, and nicely made stone toilet, which I think probably would have had some kind of something on top of it.
Yeah, maybe.
Like a bowl with a hole in it or something, you
I'm
know?
I'm not putting my fancy ass on hard stone rock. I want a cushion.
You want a cushion.
And I want a ceramic bowl.
Yes. Well, I don't know if you want to sit on a ceramic bowl.
I do every day.
Fair. I guess they could have made something sturdy enough, but
porcelain. Did they have porcelain back then there?
No, I don't think so.
Is porcelain that old?
Porcelain, it probably is in the Far East. In the Far East.
Yeah. Like China.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, so that just is really interesting to me, because it does make me wonder if the people in the upper classes that had a toilet like this would be more protected from the microorganisms in their waste. Whereas you imagine that the lower classes probably had more close contact with it, and maybe they were then, you know, getting it more.
Maybe, but it's clear that the people who were using this toilet
had these diseases. Yeah, they had microorganisms.
It's in their waste.
I guess my question would be, like, is the rate the same between the different classes? Yeah. I don't know if there's a way to know that, but it would be interesting to see.
Yeah. Man.
Yeah.
Super gross.
Yeah, totally.
Anyway, what I'm wondering too is with these, I guess, latrines, they were calling them, or privies. They're basically a hole that's dug out underneath where you're using the toilet.
Yeah.
But that has to also be excavated periodically as well. You're not just going to move your toilet in your house.
Right.
You know? So I think if somebody did excavate that for me and it was not done very well, I would want my money back. And for that, I'd probably have to keep my receipt. We'll talk about Jerusalem receipts in a minute. Back in a minute.
I did not know where you're going with that.
Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 220, and we're going to talk about a 2,000-year-old stone receipt discovered in Jerusalem.
Yeah, so we're moving forward in time a little bit here. This is newer than our last segment, but it is still Jerusalem, so they're making some good discoveries there these days.
And it's not a receipt for cleaning out your latrine.
Well,
like I implied.
I mean, we don't know. Maybe
it is. I mean, it's got writing on it.
It's got writing on it. We don't know what it's a receipt for. Yeah, so this article is called A 2,000-Year-Old Chalkstone Receipt Carved with Customer Names and Prices Was Just Uncovered in Jerusalem. And this is pretty breaking news. It just came out a couple days ago, basically. And what it is, it's a fragment of a heavy stone lid of an ossuary with 7 lines of text on it.
Yeah.
And those lines are partially legible because it is just a fragment, but they do appear to be people's names and sums of money, which is where the receipt piece of this comes from.
Yeah, they are likely what they think is a record of financial transactions, like a payment for workers or people who owed money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, it's like a ledger. Oh, is this like the guy who like has guys that go around and like pummel people for money? And this is his list of who owes him and like who needs to be pummeled.
I mean, maybe, but it was a stone lid of an ossuary.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I don't, they did not explain why it's an ossuary. I had some, maybe it's reused, you know, just a reused piece of stone. I don't know.
I mean, but, maybe, or did somebody just like want everybody to know that, listen, I might be dead, but you owe me.
But you guys all owe me. And here's your names and here's the sum of money. Oh my God. That is so, that would be the most like vindictive thing that you could possibly do, to publicly shame the people that owe you money when you die.
Like, I'm taking this to the grave.
Like, I know that I can't do anything about getting this money back right now, but I'm going to publicly shame you.
Exactly.
It's just, it's like so deeply like mean and human that I kind of love it.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's, I'm going to say that's what that was.
All right.
The authors are saying though, that it's like an ancient receipt. Now, receipts are not something that usually survive the archaeological record because they're just like, they're too mundane and nobody really purposely preserves them. You more find them by chance or, you know, maybe in a situation where like a larger institution might preserve its receipts, you know, but like an individual, it just doesn't really happen that often.
Right, right.
So the stone was dated to between 100 BCE and 100 CE. So it's straddling that millennia change there, right at the time of Jesus, if that is your cup of tea, like all that was going on in Jerusalem at that time. And based on the script, as well as similarities to other inscriptions, that's where the date comes from.
Sure. Yeah, because language is changing, I wouldn't say quickly, but enough that we can track track that, you know, and say, well, if it's written like this, then it must date to around this time frame.
Exactly. Yeah. And there's always trends too, like trends in how they write things and the way it looks. So you can follow that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So one of the inscriptions is for somebody called Shimon.
Yeah.
And that is followed by the Hebrew letter Mem.
Okay.
And Mem is apparently an abbreviation of Ma'at, which is the Hebrew word for money.
Okay.
So that's where they're getting this whole money thing from.
And Shimon was like John in early Roman times.
Yeah, it was like a popular biblical name. Yeah.
So. Although, while I haven't exactly read all of the Bible, I've literally never heard the word Shimon mentioned in any sort of biblical reference. Not that I'm a scholar on it.
But I'm not either.
If it's so common, why wouldn't I have heard it?
I think it was common for them, but not necessarily common now, if that makes sense. It's a
popular biblical name.
Yeah, that's what they said in the article.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yep.
Anyway. The stone fragment was found in a debris pile during a salvage excavation, more CRM, on Pilgrimage Road. So kind of a popular place.
Yeah, the road extends about 600 meters and it connected Jerusalem City Gate with the gates of Temple Mount. And Temple Mount is where the second temple was located.
Yeah.
So basically like the city was over here and it was 600 meters away was where their temple, where they would go for all their religious purposes, ceremonies and things like that. Yeah. So there's basically a lot of traffic on this road at that time, people going back and forth for various religious reasons to the temple.
Just a note for the listeners, Rachel's wildly gesticulating with her hands. I don't know if you can see
that. I always wildly gesticulate when I'm talking about this kind of stuff. So do you.
It's over here. It's over there. I hope you guys can visualize. Look,
it's over in the living room and then the temple is over in the bedroom. Okay.
Nice.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. In the early Roman period, so from about 37 BCE to 70 CE, this road that we're talking about was heavily trafficked.
Yeah.
And was probably a commercial hub, lending credence to what I was saying 500 years earlier about the amount of traffic coming through there.
Yes.
It's even more now.
It is. Yeah. And this was the road that connected these two places, but also they found stone weights and measuring tables in some of the excavations that they've done on this road. And that's the kind of thing that you see for commerce. So it's like, I am imagining this road that was just like lined with
vendors,
selling things. Yeah. And they had
worse
to have
than a beach in Mexico.
Yeah, I'm sure. But those guys are on the move, right? Like this is, it sounds like it must've been somewhat established if they're finding remains of weights and tables and things, you know,
it all depends on what the customers are doing, right? The customers were sitting on the beach and the vendors had to be on the move to get new customers. But here, people are walking down the road.
People are on the move. So yeah, the vendors just wait. Yeah, it's a drive-by situation.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So Jerusalem has a really interesting history with the Romans. And basically, 37 BCE is when Herod the Great captured Jerusalem after a 40-day siege. And he was there kind of like sanctioned by the Romans, basically. He wasn't Roman, but he was from Judea, but they sanctioned him to be there, basically.
Okay.
And so he took over the city, and he actually built the second temple, too.
Oh.
And he led Jerusalem into a time of prosperity, basically.
Yes.
And it was a really great time until he died and he had heirs and things didn't go well. And then they brought in the Pontius Pilate guys, whose name I can't remember what they are right now. But, the guy that executed Jesus, those guys, the protectorate people came in. They ran Jerusalem for a while. There was a lot of strife by the time we get to the 70 CE time period. The Jewish people rose up in revolt and Rome squashed them and burnt down their temple. That is a really quick and dirty history, but I just thought it was interesting to know the backdrop of what is going on at this time with this temple and the heavily trafficked road in between the city and the temple. So there you go. There's your 5-minute history of Jerusalem.
So apart from the roads, sanitation, and the aqueduct, what did the Romans ever give us? Got to bring in a Monty Python quote.
Yeah,
we're talking about
time.
Jerusalem in two different articles.
Yeah, every time.
Yeah. So it's time to watch Life of Brian again.
Oh, I know. I haven't seen that one in a really long time.
You want a good history of that area? That's just how you watch it.
Do you think that
it's from a secondhand source? So you have to, it's not Jesus, it's Brian.
Oh, my God.
So, you know.
Man. Yep.
All right. Well, there's lots of cool things coming out there. And as we head into the field season for a lot of places in the Northern Hemisphere, it's kind of interesting because news articles continue to come out because journals continue to publish, but I feel like there should really be like a drop off in this kind of stuff because people are doing a lot of field work over the summer.
Mm-hmm.
Just because a lot of people that do this field work are also academic professors and they teach and do their analysis and write up during the school year.
Yeah. So, they get that stuff done by the end of the year and then they're heading out into another field season.
Right.
Yeah. But
that means that we might see a lot more press releases like this because, you know, they haven't had time to write it up, but they still want to get it out there. Mm-hmm. And in some places, you know, it's really important for them to do that. You don't often see that with US CRM projects unless it's a high profile project.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it's somewhere that everybody can see and it's not, you can't hide it and it's not in the middle of the desert in Nevada for a mine somewhere that's run out of Canada, then you're probably going to hear about it in a press release.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, yeah.
So speaking of press releases, I thought it might be kind of fun to just do like a quick update on Miami.
Oh my God.
We have a little bit of extra time in this segment, and there was an article that came out recently about it, and we weren't going to talk about it because it's not really archaeology related, but we do talk about Miami on here kind of a lot since we both worked on the project there 20 years ago, but the new project is ongoing.
20 years ago?
17?
God, it was like
18 years ago?
Yeah.
Yeah, 2005.
Oh my God.
That was 18 years ago, my friend.
That's upsetting.
I know. So anyway, there's a recent article that came out called "Archaeologists at the Ancient Tequesta Site in Miami Are Getting Sick at Risk of Cancer."
Yeah.
And it does seem a little bit alarmist, but there's probably some truth there. And it is really interesting that the way the archaeology companies, I'm not going to name anybody. We don't need to go down that road. It's all in the article if you want to go read it, which we'll link to in the show notes. Mm-hmm. But some of the archaeologists have reported getting sick and various different symptoms, rashes, vomiting, diarrhea, upset stomach, that kind of thing, nausea.
Yeah.
And they're saying that they're being exposed to chemicals on this excavation that they're working on, which is an old oil tank storage area from a while ago. And they say that that's causing illness. So
I didn't know that. The other articles we read didn't say we used to be there.
No, they didn't. And this was not true of the area that we worked in. Right. But they're smelling things. Like they say that things like smell really bad as they're digging through. So anyway, it's just really interesting to see how that is progressing and hopefully they're going to mediate any unsafe circumstances, or, you know, this is just a complaint and the investigation is still ongoing. So we don't know how valid the complaints are yet. Not that I want to take away anybody's, you know, thunder, but there's still an investigation to be done. So,
And this is why doing historical background research on places is really important, not just to understand what you might find, but for the safety of the archaeologists as well. I'm shocked that they didn't plan for this a little better and just prepare for it and have them wearing protective gear just in case they found something.
Yeah.
Do you remember when we worked in North Carolina near the Cape Fear River?
I do. I know what you're. Yeah.
There was one spot where it just like smelled.
It smelled terrible.
Yeah. I don't know what it was or what was going on there.
It was kind of like a chemical smell. And
what did we do for that? Didn't we like, we had to wear gloves for sure.
We wore gloves. I think we ended up not digging there.
Yeah, maybe.
Like they were maybe going to do more testing, but they decided not to for safety reasons or something like that. I never felt unsafe though. Like when we started smelling something weird, they
backed away.
Yeah, we backed out immediately, but
we weren't forced to dig in it.
No. Well, and everybody does have a choice. So you do wonder like how up front they were with potential safety concerns, but you know, if it's an actual like hazmat issue, you need to have full gear for that. And they're clearly not doing that. Right. I have seen projects like old hospitals and things like that, where people do have to wear like full hazmat gear. So if they were worried about safety, then that should have been the route that they went. But I don't know.
One other time I could think that we were in a potentially unsafe situation, but again, we're able to get out of it, is I remember this one mine, and I want to say it's south of I-80. Between like Battle Mountain and wherever. But anyway, it was this mine. I remember exactly where
Bay-a-Wawe
it was.
There, like out that way.
But down south of there. Okay. Yeah. And I remember working out there, and we saw these barrels that had like this white substance in it. And cyanide was used a lot.
Yeah. To
help. Was it silver? I think it was for silver. It helps essentially, like, this isn't the right term, but it helps like dissolve or melt away the rock and leaves silver behind. Okay. Right. So it helps get rid of the matrix. That's not the right way to say it exactly, but it helps to extract the silver. I think it was either silver or gold. That's one of the two things they were using that for. But yeah, you could smell this. Like, I don't know if it was cyanide. They say it smells like almonds, I think, but old cyanide didn't smell like almonds.
Well, it's something that's been sitting out in the desert for, you know, 100 years, maybe. Like, how could you know?
Whatever it was a funky white substance that didn't smell great in a big barrel.
Yeah. Stay away. Just stay away.
Yeah. You just don't want to get in on that. Yeah.
But yeah, it does bring up those questions of like sometimes that relationship between a developer and a CRM company and the other parties. Sometimes they want to move so fast that maybe safety concerns aren't addressed properly or fully ahead of time. And I'm wondering if as this story continues, if we're going to find out more that maybe safety was less of a priority when they were planning this project, which is unfortunate.
Yeah. Well, and I can think of one more circumstance that I was just thinking of, because I didn't think of it from a chemical standpoint, but still a dangerous situation an archaeologist can be in. When we worked on my company that I have, I worked on the China Lake Naval Weapons Center. Obviously, I mean, anything metal, we weren't allowed to even touch.
Yeah. Right? You had rules from the Navy.
We did.
That you had to follow. Yeah.
Because they knew. And we had explosive ordnance technicians with us at all times. Each crew had an EOD person with them. Explosive ordnance disposal. And we were supposed to stop for anything metal. We weren't supposed to poke at it, kick it, or touch it, because it could be an unexploded piece of ordnance. And not only that, so that's hazardous to your health if that goes off. But also, the Navy and the military in general likes to use in some weapons, and I think it's for like armor piercing bullets and stuff like that, but also other things. They use depleted uranium, which is highly radioactive.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So it's not just the explosion that was the potential problem, but the
could actually be radioactive.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
So you don't want to pick it up. You don't want to touch
it. What about like a can dump? Could you get in there and record that safely, or did you have to let your guy go through it first?
Well, I don't think we found a single one of those.
Oh, you didn't? Okay. Okay. Yeah. Well, I guess people weren't there. So
they were there in some settlements. So we did find some settlements that would have had stuff like that, but that was clearly like a house area.
Yeah.
So that was okay. But just walking out on the landscape, that's where it was really dangerous, because it was ranching before the 1940s when the Navy took over. There wasn't any like real mining or anything out there where they would have had established mines and stuff where you would find a can dump. And when people are ranching out there, they don't have can dumps generally. They might have a couple of cans where they stopped and had lunch and just chucked them on the ground.
Right.
But no like big things like that. Yeah. So for those random one-off things, we were still supposed to call EOD over and say, hey, you know, poke
check
at this.
It out.
And,
yeah.
You know, archaeologists use pin flags to like you see the, you know, the phone company or something using.
Yeah, like a metal, the metal shaft and then the plasticky bit on the top. Yeah.
Well, on this project, we weren't allowed to use metal pin flags. We had to use fiberglass pin flags because anything metal that you poke into the ground could just poke into something that could explode.
Yeah.
And so fiberglass is less likely to make it do that.
Right.
So the scarier pieces of, so they had these different kinds of cluster bombs that they would test out there. And only one in every, you know, 10 or 20 or something like that had a shotgun shell like cartridge in it, mm-hmm. that would let off a smoke bomb. So the rest were inert. They were dummy bombs.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But you never know which one of those has the shotgun shell in it that didn't go off.
Right.
And even though it's a small charge for one of these things, it could still take your hand off or, you know, shoot through your chest or something like that. So the scariest ones of those, because some of them are like baseball sized, like softball sized,
mm-hmm.
were the ones that you're just walking along and you happen to be standing there and you see just a little bit of it peeking out of the sand. They're not like sitting on the surface a lot of times.
Oh, that's so scary because like you could see just a little bit of it, but how many did you not see? You know, right, is the question. Oh my gosh, that's crazy.
All right, well, this doesn't really have anything to do with Jerusalem.
It has nothing to do with Jerusalem or archaeology. Well, a little bit with archaeology, but safety and archaeology.
Yeah.
And I just thought it would be fun to give a quick update on Miami since we have talked about that site so much on this show. So go read the article. We'll link to it. Make your own judgments on how they did or did not break safety rules. And yeah, it's just an ongoing drama down there, it sounds like.
And I wouldn't be surprised if even the 2,500-year-old privies they were digging out from the first article had material in it that wasn't completely hardened and solid.
Oh, probably.
I mean, these things.
Probably super gross.
It was probably super gross. And they probably had protective gear.
That's why you have to wear the safety gear on old hospital sites too, is because you don't know what kind of microbes might be there that could be bad. So be safe, everybody. Just be safe out there.
Well, on that note, I think we'll leave it. So we'll see you next week with something else.
All right. Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at arcpodnet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.